assuming that you were listening on a wonderful, crisp spring evening. I don't know.
You Welcome were trying it. Really hard for about 5 seconds. I did not know what was happening. Good evening.
Good evening. Good evening. Welcome to another episode of American Basies. I am Arjun.
And I'm Akash.
Today we have joining our guest, as our guest, actually a dear friend of my mother's. They grew up spending time together in Kanpur. Is that correct? Kanpur, yeah?
Yes.
And but we have here my Sujata auntie, Sujata Winfield. Welcome to American Daisies. Thank you for having me. She has a laser wit and will probably cut down me and Akash a number of times. I am excited for this.
We hung out last night. It was the first time any of us had met.
Yep.
And it was like family all hanging out, and she was putting me in my place very quickly.
I wasn't aware of doing all that. But
this is as well behaved as I'm going to be, not out of respect as much as out of fear that you're going to be funnier than me. So there you go.
One of the things that was most exciting for us to talk about and most interesting was, you know, we get it in your name, Sujata Winfield. You are married to a non-Indian. And it was intimated last night that there was quite an interesting story behind that encounter and subsequent relationship. And we were excited to talk about it and share it.
Sure.
So you, listen, I had the first question. I got you. So you met your husband, you said, at Parsons?
I did.
Okay. And for some people who hypothetically might not know where Parsons is, these unenlightened folks, where is Parsons?
Parsons School of Divine is in New York City.
In New York City. Mm-hmm. And you had come from India to go to school specifically there?
No, I hadn't actually. I mean, I had come because my brother was sick with Hodgkin's disease.
Oh, wow.
He was my younger brother, youngest of the three of us, following a younger sister. And he was 15 when he was diagnosed with Hodgkin's. So we grew up in a joint family, and the joint family money basically brought him here to be treated at Sloan Kettering. Here meaning New York City. To be treated. And I had just finished college, so I joined my parents 6-8 months later.
Okay. Was the reason to come to the States just that the medical care at that time was just... for cancer was just better?
I think Sloan Kettering was known as being the best.
Okay.
And my family, my grandparents said that he needs to be taken where treatment is the best. So my family had some business dealings in the U.S., so it wasn't entirely alien. Mm-hmm. My uncle used to travel for work. Mm-hmm. So at that time, my parents and my brother were accompanied by my uncle, my cha-cha, and he, and there was a family friend who lived in Flushing, and that's where they found an apartment close to his place.
Okay.
So your brother's undergoing treatment at this time.
Yes.
And you decide to come out and spend time to be there as support. But you weren't there just for a week. You were there for some time.
I was there for a year, yeah.
You were there for a year. Was, at some point you had to figure out what to do with your time as well. Was that a hard thing to figure out what to do? I mean, had you been to the States before?
No. So it was thrilling, of course, to be in New York City. Of course, my brother's being sick was a ghastly thing happening to us because we were very, very, very close to him. In fact, he was the apple of everyone's eye, the entire joint family. It's quite unique as a person. Did many unusual things when he was young. So at any rate, but treatment had started by now, and it's amazing how you can get used to accepting certain things that have happened, which once upon a time would have struck great fear at the thought of it happening, if the C word was rarely used. And by this time, we were used to the fact that he was undergoing cancer treatment, basically. So when I came to New York, I wanted to do art because I'd always been interested in drawing and painting. And so I joined this class at Parsons, a drawing class. It was for 6 weeks. And my dad, being very conservative, I mean, we come from a conservative joint family, he said to my mom that don't let her go. You know how flighty she is. She will fall in love with someone. And so Amma said, let her do what she wants to do, because at home she can't do so many things. And what do you think, she's going to marry an American, or what are you afraid of?
Oh, wow.
So just let her do what she wants to do. And that's been had been my mother's attitude all the time. We did so very many things in that joint family because she fought for them. And my brother always used to say that Amma fought for all the freedoms that we have. She fought for her own freedoms, and she in a way changed the course of the family's life in a way by simply knocking her head against the wall and chipping away.
I know this is kind of a detour from the story, but it was an interesting thing that your daughter brought up last night. You talked about fighting freedom. Your grandparents, right, were involved in the fight for India's freedom. Is that right?
That was my maternal grandparents.
Yes.
So, yes, they were. So in Kanpur, was quite a hub of political activity. Mm-hmm. And then my grandfather was very much involved in the Congress Party. Mm-hmm. And my grandmother also became involved.
Congress Party was the party of Nehru, correct?
Yeah. I mean, that was the party that fought for the freedom of India. And so various, I mean, there was a hall close by called Tilak Hall, where a lot of the famous Congress people gathered, and it was a gathering place for members, and people gave speeches and whatnot. So that was close around the corner from our house. And we lived in Kanpur, right on the main street called Meston Road. Mm-hmm. And so Chandrasekhar Azad, the famous revolutionary, was in hiding. Nobody knew who he looked like, what he looked like. And there was a price on his head, and there were posters up, wanted posters up. And he was living at my grandparents' place just as a friend, and because nobody knew what he looked like, he was pretty much going out with them for walks and this and that. And so there's a story that my aunt, my Mossy, this is before my mom was born, she was a baby and she was lying next to my grandmother, and Chandrasekhar Azad was sitting there cleaning his gun. And very calmly cleaning his gun. And my grandmother was quite young, maybe 17 or 18, maybe 19 at that time, I think. And then the gun went off and a bullet whizzed past.
Oh my God.
My Mossy's ear.
Wow.
And then it got stuck in a veranda where we always knew the place where the bullet had gone. And so my grandmother shrieked and she said, you're not worried about you could have killed my daughter. And he very calmly kept on polishing his gun. And he said that when so many people are being killed in India, what is the life of one child, which could be considered to be idealistic or brutal or harsh, whichever way you get it. But basically, he was single-minded in his pursuit of using revolutionary means to get rid of the Brits.
So freedom fighter activism, you've mentioned that your mother was also, in a way, fighting for freedom in another way, in the way that she fought for her freedoms. Is that something that you value? Is that something that you feel like you've inherited from that lineage, this fighting for something, whether it's freedoms in a grander sense or in a smaller sense?
I think so. I mean, perhaps, several factors probably went into the making of who I am. Of course, my mother's fights for freedom, and to some extent my paternal grandfather, who always told me, because being very conservative head of the family, it's part of that conservative thinking that you're not going to go out to work, and after all, I'm earning a living, I'm looking after you, why do you need to work? And right. So there was that philosophy which we used to argue against all the time, because when you're young, you somehow think there's great merit in going out and getting a job.
Yeah.
And he said, "Nahi karna hai to do voluntary work, but not for money." We found that really old-fashioned. And, but I think that upbringing against which I rebelled so much then became a part of me, because I find now that in the work that I do, there was a certain social idealism that grew, whereby I wanted to change the nature of the social order. And in Calcutta, you see a lot of extremes of wealth and poverty, people on the roads and people in the mansions,
right.
City of palaces and slums. So they grew up, perhaps a combination of my mom, because at that time, of course, we didn't know that mom was fighting for things when we were young,
right?
And that sensibility came later. Mm-hmm. But yes, we knew about the freedom fighting background, and then my grandfather's insistence, ki voluntary. So at some point, I think all of these things probably contributed to making my persona.
Yeah, it seems like, maybe I'm wrong, but it seems like two completely different styles of thinking. One maternal, which is kind of like rebellious, do your own thing, don't conform,
yeah,
and form your own path. And the other, it's like, this is how it's been done, this is how it's going to be. And those both, I guess, ended up...
But it seemed like the commonality was in service of something other than self.
Oh, that's a good point.
Yeah.
That was the commonality. For context, we were talking about Kanpur as where your grandparents were, but you were raised in Calcutta.
I was raised in Calcutta. Okay. I would go to Kanpur only during... in September, October, when in Calcutta you had the Durga Puja holidays. Mm-hmm. In Kanpur, it was the time for Ram Leela and Dashera. So, you know, that was the time we had holidays and we would go to Kanpur once a year.
And then the second, just point of context, is talking about the work that you now do, which we actually didn't mention, which was you are an immigration lawyer.
I am an immigration lawyer, yeah.
So I guess that answers the question of whether you're fighting or not. You're definitionally fighting. You do immigration law here in the States.
Yes.
But you are based in Atlanta.
In Athens, Georgia, but the immigration offices and the courts are in Atlanta. So,
okay.
So I work for my office, and when necessary, I go into Atlanta.
Was immigration law what you first started?
No, I started doing employment discrimination law. And so when I came to the U.S., I decided to do law. I decided in India that I wanted to do something that gave me an opportunity to bring about social change. Now, I worked in orphanages and such places, but these places were dominated by social society, women running social organizations, and I didn't feel that I could have a role to play.
When you say social society women, you mean...
No, I mean that just society ladies, basically.
Society ladies, yeah. That kind of debutante southern...
Yeah, and important, yeah. I mean, doing good work, no doubt. But then, you know, when you're a youngster and you have older people dominating,
yeah,
and personalities dominating a social organization, in my case, I felt that really that was not my thing, and mm-hmm, that I wouldn't be effective. I was too timid in a way also. And then secondly, I'd studied philosophy in college, and I felt that, you know, I was interested in issues of social justice, philosophically speaking, and I thought that law was an area where I could combine two things, as it involved, on the one hand, intellectual issues of, mm-hmm, of justice. It also gave me a chance to be practically useful and be good and be helpful, and those, you know, naive, perhaps idealistic ideas that I had growing up, I felt that could be translated into something more solid through the study of law. So that's the aim with which I went to law school. And then I stuck to looking for jobs in the area where I could be of use to the disadvantaged.
Right. Yeah,
disadvantaged was the... I wanted to work for the disadvantaged. And again, it had its roots in growing up in Calcutta and seeing these great disparities, yeah, in income. So so then I looked around for jobs, and I was thinking of legal aid or legal services. But I also wanted to work part-time because I was wanted to have kids and all of that. So ultimately, I got a job in an employment discrimination law firm. They let me work part-time. And, you know, I loved the job. I was there for 12 years. And what was interesting was that I managed to get a lot of privileges from them because, in a way, I had nothing going for myself. When I was in law school, every summer I went off to India.
Mm.
I didn't intern and didn't do any of the things that you're supposed to do in order to get a job.
And so you went to law school in America?
I went to law school in the U.S. and University of Georgia. In the meantime, of course, I got married.
Right. So we rewind. Yeah, let's rewind back to America. So you met your future current husband when you were in this art class in Parsons.
Yes.
So tell us about, was it love at first sight? Let's get romantic here.
Let's get romantic here. No, it wasn't love at first sight. It was, I walk into the class, I was a couple of days late, and there was this guy, a lot of old people. He was the youngish fellow with red hair, red afro.
Red afro.
And he was making, there were a couple models, a guy and a gal, and he was painting them blue and orange.
Mm.
So I thought to myself, blue? Why is the guy blue? At any rate, so I sat there and I started doing my own sketching and things. of course, the guy was in the nude, which was my first reaction was almost to shut my eye. Yeah. But precisely the kind of thing my father wanted me not to be exposed to. But then as time went on, you know, we talked a little, and I found out that he was a philosopher. I mean, looking for a job at that time, that he had. Gradually, I found out all the interests that I had, except that he had made much more of them. Like, he was definitely doing, you know, he was a good artist. Mm-hmm. He was very fond of music and literature and basically everything mm-hmm. else he knew about. Mm-hmm. Basically a Renaissance man. The kind of person I always wanted to marry, but I never thought that I would ever meet somebody like that in India. Of course, at that time, I was not thinking of marriage in the least.
Right. Mm-hmm. And he was white, and he is white.
He is white, and absolutely not, because you don't. And in India, we are very smug in a certain way. It's the Firangi, the white man, is looked down upon because of the color of his skin.
Right.
And we think our color, skin color, is the best.
Yeah.
And
But we want them to be as fair as possible.
But we usually lift up light skin, right?
Well, the older generation does, isn't it? And the younger generation tends to think that, dark skin is better.
I mean, otherwise,
why call someone a Firangi, right? Mm-hmm. In our generation.
Yeah. I thought Firangi just meant foreigner.
It does, but it's a derogatory term.
Yeah.
A lot of the being derogatory at that time didn't have to do with the Brits colonizing India, but it had to do with white skin.
Right.
That somehow, somewhere, in a subterranean manner, we were thinking that those with white skin are pale and insipid.
Were you confronting any of your own prejudices, or were you not? Did you not subscribe to that line of thinking when you met him?
I think somewhere I also must have felt the same. But what I felt that New York City did over the course of the 1 year I was there, and the time I spent hanging out with Richard, because I did start hanging out with him without telling my parents.
Mm.
And we would go to see him, hang out in art galleries and this and that. So during that time, I realized that, the skin color just didn't matter. And perhaps New York City has that impact on you. That for someone fairly traditional, though very rebellious in the framework of my joint family, I was extremely rebellious. But nevertheless, I operated in a certain structure out of which I never saw myself. Mm-hmm. But in New York City, suddenly, this white man, it didn't matter that he was white, and I was hanging out with him.
So when did you realize that this was something different than just friendship?
Over the course of the year, I think.
There was no moment that was like, oh, this is...
No, there's no eureka moment, but I felt that, perhaps I could take on my family with respect to thinking of marriage. And in fact, so something like that. I mean, it just gradually moved into that feeling.
Was he understanding of the cultural situation that you were about to enter, or did you have to do a lot of cultural education around that?
No, I didn't do, because most of the time it was such a natural process that at no point was I thinking of getting married.
Mm-hmm. Oh, okay.
So it was just that, okay, I'm here in New York City, just want to hang out with someone who, is fun to be with. We share so many things in common. He knows so much more about all the things I'm interested in than I do. And, for example, he introduced me to these double movie deals. So I saw a lot of Orson Welles films. I mean, he used to see a lot of films when he was in college, and he just passed that on to me. So these kinds of things. He didn't have to be coaxed into anything. He was just listening to my stories.
Right.
And at the end of it, he said that, well, maybe you can stay on after your parents go, when it came time to go back home. Mm. My brother's treatment was over. And I said, no, that is not done, etc. So I'm going back home.
But so you did?
I did. But then there was some talk. Once I jokingly asked him, would you marry me? And then he still points it out as being my making move. I said, no, I was just curious.
Because that's such a guy move right there.
Yeah.
Now you asked me.
But then...
She did.
But then you see that if I in India had even looked at a guy, I would have gotten a thrashing from my... a lot of things I did. I used to play cricket in college. And we were being coached by a whole bunch of exciting guys who played Ranji mm-hmm. Trophy. and all that. And I was terrified that when my dad or my uncles went to drop me for cricket practice, that they would see that I was being coached by guys and everything would come to an end. Mm. So there was always this no-no around guys.
Yeah.
Right.
And here I was in America, there's no question of thinking of marriage to an American.
Right.
You know? But then it happened in this way, and I sometimes even think that the only thing that I did that I could be credited with in this whole saga of my marriage is actually falling in love with a white guy without...
That's so interesting. That would be the one thing that I would be like, well, you didn't have a choice in that, because if you fall in love with who you fall in love with. That's interesting that that's the one thing that you're crediting yourself with.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Because, I mean, it's not as though it was love at first sight, because it can't be, because I was not conditioned to think or in terms of falling in love in that manner to someone so different.
I mean, were you growing up, just for contextualization, were you raised thinking that you were going to have an arranged marriage?
Yeah, definitely, yeah. Definitely. Yeah. But I was rebellious enough that I said that I'm going to keep saying no until I find the right guy. And I said no to many guys, you know. And everyone was at their wits' end as to how to find a guy for me, because I didn't like anyone who came along. Mm-hmm. And, you know, of course, I had my prejudices. I thought business people were... my family was a business family. I didn't want to have anything to do with businessmen.
So how did this shift? So what happened? You go back to India. Mm-hmm. You're back in India. Are you still in contact with Richard?
Yeah, I'm in contact with Richard, and he makes collect calls. No, I make collect.
You
no,
have to
I
make collect
calls.
Right.
Yeah, that's how it works. So he and then he proposes to me on the phone, and so that's exciting. And I said yes, yes. I'll marry you. I love you. And that was all very fine. And then he says, he says these famous words, okay, it's all right. Take your time. No rush. And I proceeded to take my time, which was 2 years.
Wow. And,
wow.
During which I absolutely did not move any further in making a decision.
And the decision was based on... to leave or not to leave, or to tell your parents? Or
no, like... no. So I had to tell my parents if I'm going to proceed, right?
Yeah.
So each, I mean, I think the days of happiness were over by the time I got back to India and he proposed. And one felt elated by that proposing. After that, it all became really... more and more excruciating emotionally. Because then I had to first tell my mom, and like my relationship with my mother was such that I just could not do anything without her. I mean, we're completely wrapped up in each other. Mm-hmm. And in fact, telling a lie and hanging out with Richard was, you know, really tough for me to do. So I had to tell her, and I sort of conveniently have forgotten the details of how I told her. She just brushed it aside first and, you know, didn't take it seriously. But then I persisted. And then she said, okay, well, then you have to mention it to the next person, which is Dad. And I remember for 6 months, every morning I got up thinking I'm going to tell him. And every night I went to sleep without telling him.
Wow. Mm.
And it was completely torturous.
During this whole time, you're still in contact with Richard.
Yeah, off and on.
And he was... he sounds like he was amazingly supportive and not...
Yeah, he was. I mean, he was waiting.
Right.
And he was saying, do this, do that, or whatever. Or haven't you done it? I mean, I don't remember, except that he was waiting. And I said that this just has to take its own time, because I'm not being able to do it.
Right.
I mean, it's one thing to fall in love. It's another thing to get married. And this is the scenario over here. And the thing is that, you know, I'm extremely close to my joint family as well. So when I told my father, then he was, of course, devastated. And, of course, he immediately got extremely angry with my mom. And I kaha tha na ki, don't send her to art class.
Mm-hmm.
And then, so that created immediately conflict between them. Mm. And then, of course, then he pretended as if nothing had happened and wasn't going to help me to bring up the issue with my grandparents, because we lived in a joint family and nothing happened.
You
without
have to go one by one to everyone. This is
one by one. And then and the setup was such that I would never even leave the house without popping into my grandparents' room,
right,
touching their feet, saying I'm going. So now I have to bring up this issue with them. So I brought it up. It took another 6 months to bring it up, and then the whole family knew, and then it became the raging topic.
Discussion.
And my aunts and uncles, everyone getting involved, and a lot of yelling and all that going on downstairs.
Did you have any support?
My mom was my only supporter. My mother was my only supporter. Wow. And my sister and brother were younger at that point. Of course, they were supportive, but I never talked to, discussed anything with them.
Right.
Then my grandparents were really wanting my mother to give them my passport.
Wow, so that you couldn't...
Yeah, leave. But she didn't. She hid my passport. And so my father got really upset with my mother. My dad is the oldest son of his parents. They were four brothers. So my father felt responsible as the oldest son to go along with his parents. And my mother said, I'm with my daughter. So that created a lot of conflict between my parents, which was very difficult for me to watch.
Right.
And my mother became very, very anxious because she became bulimic and she was throwing up every day.
Oh, my God.
And so all of this was going on for 2 years.
Was there any point where you said, I'm not going to? Was there any point where you thought that?
No, I mean, I kept questioning myself and wondering why I was doing this, because since there's such commotion on one side and people are falling sick and the family fabric is seeming to be, you know, torn apart. Then I was wondering, why am I even thinking of going ahead? And at one point my mother asked me that, do you love him? And I said, yes, not knowing really what that meant anymore.
Mm.
Because when your emotions are someone, there is so much pressure on them. There is. Then you wonder, are they even real?
Right.
I mean, how important is it? After all, if I let it go, it's not as though I won't find someone else I would like to marry. Maybe, why shouldn't that happen also?
Mm-hmm.
Right? I mean, it's just that there was a relationship I had with Richard in New York City, which was exhilarating.
Mm-hmm.
And it's on the basis of that, and I felt close to him, and I felt that we could share a life together. And those feelings is what I based all of this on.
Right.
Now, when that is, you know, being tested in a way, and that's what my mother is hinging her decision on, you know, do you really feel something for him? My answer was a shot in the dark. I mean, I just said yes, because I couldn't say no. Because once upon a time, this is how I did feel for Richard, right?
I feel like the fact that you did say yes and that you couldn't say no didn't make it a shot in the dark. It just made it the truth.
I don't know. I mean, maybe I just couldn't say no. But I wonder about what it was that compelled me to say yes to my mother. And because at that point, my mother said, okay, fine. And then she went about her, you know, business. She got all my clothes together. She put it away at my... her friend's place, packed my suitcase in effect, and was looking for an opportunity for my grandparents to leave so that she could send me off. And that's when Richard had actually sent an open ticket.
Wow.
And of course, he was giving me deadline after deadline for...
Yeah, have you ever asked him how he felt? Like, I mean, this is 2 years of wondering. Because if you can't come, which you can't, no one can blame you for, then he's just devastated and... You know, he's going through his own thing also.
But frankly, I think I was not very considerate of his waiting because I was immersed in so much of grief all around, including my own self grieving for what I was doing, which is the strangest thing, which I was doing to my family, because I could suddenly see it from everyone's point of view, how they would deal with an American son-in-law. That my grandfather, who always put down everyone who ran away with someone or the other, you know, they're businessmen, so there was a market, the bazaar ke log, you know, their business workplace where everyone knew everyone. There would be a lot of gossip about so-and-so's daughter went off with so-and-so, so-and-so. My grandfather would be very, you know, down upon these things, and now he was having to face the same situation. And, you know, what does a traditional Indian or any Indian know what to do with a white guy?
Yeah.
I mean, you expect you grow up your daughter with hopes of marrying her off into a wonderful family and gaining a family.
Yeah.
And marriage being the joining of two families. And here, I was the oldest grandchild, much pampered.
A lot of expectations upon you.
Many expectations that because I was so full of fancies that the guy I would eventually marry would be somebody quite unique. All of those expectations were there. My uncle, who would travel to America, had been collecting a dowry for me.
Wow.
He would be bringing things like a paint set and makeup, and all of these things were being collected. So all these things were really heartbreaking for me in my own efforts to move beyond this petrified state I was in, having said, yes, I love you and I'll marry you.
Mm-hmm.
Richard at that point told me that, look, it's not that you have to, this is why marriage is called taking a plunge. You have to take the plunge because none of your doubts are ever going to be resolved because they are unresolvable. I didn't want to leave India ever. And I didn't want to do something against the wishes of my parents, family. And neither of these things are going to be resolved. My mother told me that you can't want to have your cake and eat it too. You can't expect to do this and do it with the approval of the family. You have to do it by yourself.
So you do it. So what happens?
Then my mother, my grandparents leave and my mom says, now's the time to go. And I immediately say, my immediate feeling was, I don't want to go. I want this thing to last forever. But then I had to go.
Because the familiar is safer than the unknown.
So leaving home then, but she was quite firm at that point. And so we went and we confirmed the ticket. And Amma told the travel person, forget which airlines it was, Lufthansa or what, that please don't reveal that she's on the flight if anyone asks.
Wow.
And they said, well, we don't usually honor such requests, but then he was taken by the story. So basically I told my father I was going to a friend's house, my dad and my uncles all coming back from work when I left. And that scene I can never forget. Everyone was in a jolly mood and my dad was his usual cheerful self. Kaha ja rahe ho? And I said, I'm going to Kumkum's place. And then the kids of my mother's friend, they took me to the airport. The girl and her fiancé. And then I flew off. Like I was like a frozen completely.
So what's that feeling like when you get on the plane starts on the tarmac and then it takes off, wheels up? What are you feeling then?
I'm feeling frozen. I'm not feeling anything. I can't feel anything. I'm so numb with everything having happened, the enormity of what I've done and what's going on back home, that I didn't think of anything.
Did that carry over when you saw your husband, or did that just melt away as soon as you saw him?
No, nothing like that. I mean, my first thought when I landed, even before I saw Richard, my first thought when I landed in New York was, I want to go back home. I don't want to live here. And then that feeling persisted when I went from the airport to Long Island, where my mother-in-law was. Because by that time, Richard had got a job in Athens, teaching philosophy.
Oh, wow.
His first university job.
Wow.
After 5 years of waiting and doing adjunct teaching in New York and surrounding areas. So he had driven up. And my in-laws also, in all these 2 years, had been waiting for something to happen, and they were on high alert and all that. So driving from New York City to Long Island was very suffocating, because then the car windows were up and the cars were swishing around. I felt like throwing up, and I said, where am I? You know, New York City as it was when I first met Richard had vanished.
Right.
Instead was this foreign place that I didn't want to live in, huh?
I grew up in Georgia.
Well, at that time, it was even just being in America that was something I was not liking in the least. And so that feeling persisted for 1 week, actually, despite Richard being there, despite everything. The marriage was with the Justice of Peace had been set for a particular day, 3 or 4 days after I got there.
Wow.
And I told Richard, I can't. I can't do it. So then they pushed the date a little bit. So I mean, now I feel later on when I thought about the trauma it created for him at that point, when after all this I come and then I say I want to go back and nothing he's saying or doing is making a difference.
How long have you been married now?
33 years. Tomorrow. Day after tomorrow. Yeah.
Wow.
Congrats.
Congratulations.
Yeah. My brother was studying at Yale at that time and he came. As soon as I landed and I got home to my in-law's place, he was there.
Oh, wow.
So I said that more than Richard, he was the person whose arms I wanted to fall into. Mm. And he was just there for the evening, actually, to go back. But it was wonderful to see him. And he was completely cool and, you know, quite thrilled that I had made it, actually. And
well, the reason I asked how long you've been married, because you have been married for 33 years, or I'm about to be 33 years. By the time this airs, it will be 33 years. It sounded like an intense process, and it sounds, at this moment, the way the story is being told, it sounded quite traumatic. There must be a shift to keep you for 33 years with this. It turns into something wonderful, right?
Yeah. I mean, because see, that was the time it got, I was completely frozen. I think it was just the impact of what I had done
the
and
shock.
The implications that this would have for the rest of my life, or just the plain and simple environment around me, going into Long Island. It's not New York City. You're going through the, you know, whatever the highway is called in New York. I forget.
Van Wyck, maybe.
And car was swishing. Everything is so different from India. Mm-hmm. It's no street life, no nothing. And there I am with my in-laws. And so everything was alien. And I was just, it was a very physical reaction to everything. I'm not liking anything. And Richard didn't figure in it, or nothing figured except what I had done.
Yeah.
You know, which feeling I didn't have on the plane, because then, as I said, I was numb.
Right.
Then
you blamed
I took
yourself a lot.
I blamed myself a lot because first and foremost, it was not easy for me to hurt my parents in such a big way. And even my mother, when she asked me, do you love the guy, she would have been the happiest person if I had said no. I mean, she would have been very happy if I had not gone ahead with this. But yet she made me go.
Have you ever asked your parents if they still, or did they ever blame you as much as you blame yourself? I wonder if this is you being in hard on yourself and internalizing the blame, or like, is that question make sense?
No, look, Richard became very much accepted by the family eventually, very quickly.
Oh, wow.
But it was a long story too, because 7 years he wasn't allowed into the family home.
Oh, wow.
And each time my parents would find a place, rent a space, where we would all move out, because when I went back myself, Richard came for half the time. And I didn't want to stay alone with him, away from my family. Because it's like, having done what I wanted to, now all I wanted was my family. And so people told me that you should only come for the duration of time. Richard comes and stay away if he's not allowed into the family house. You have no business staying in the family house either.
Wow.
This is my mom's side of the family, my mossies and mama and all of them who were less conservative. This is a slight to your husband, and that he's not allowed, and why do you keep going there?
Right.
I said, no, I can't do without my family. I don't care. But then my parents would then shift out. We would stay there. And this went on for 7 years, and during which time I was constantly talking to my grandparents, to my aunts and uncles, you know, why don't you have him come home? Why don't you have him come home?
And they'd never met him. Like, they were refusing.
No, my grandfather then very surreptitiously went out and met him somewhere else. Because he was a philosopher also of sorts, self-made intellectual, and he was interested in that aspect of Richard.
Right.
So they had a very interesting meeting, which I have on tape. And my grandfather, being a businessman, he was saying that, so you have to write books to make money or something. And so Richard said, no, I'm not interested in making money. I'm interested in posterity. Wow. And they're having this discussion.
Oh, this had this wonderful debate.
Yeah, and but my grandfather was very fond of Richard right away. But nobody knew that he had gone out of the house to meet Richard. So during this time, yeah, nobody else had met him. And each person at home, I mean, it was very excruciating for me to bring it up each time. I go sit down, I pluck up my guts, and I ask my grandmother, "Aap usko bula kyun nahi leti hai ghar par?" And like, I would feel like throwing up each time, gearing myself to bring it up. And it's almost as though after I had done the conversation, I was so relieved that for another week or two, I didn't have to start again, even if the answer was no. And each member of the family I spoke to said, my chachis and that said, we don't mind, it's the others who object.
Oh, wow, what bureaucracy.
So, you can never get out of that.
Yeah.
Who are the others? Well, the others are saying others as well.
Yeah.
So for 7 years, this was happening.
How long was it? I'm sorry. How long was it before your first trip back?
No, I went immediately the next year.
So then a year.
No, actually, one of my uncles passed away 6 months after, so I went home for that.
Okay.
That was very tragic. And my father's next brother. And then after that, I went next summer.
Were you accepted immediately? Was
I was accepted immediately.
Okay.
In fact...
Oh, there wasn't anger about the fact that you snuck away?
Well, no, they didn't show anything to me. See, when I came to Long Island, the first thing I had to do was talk to my father. I'd left a letter for him, and then I spoke to him. And he was, of course, very upset, but he was, I mean, Amma said that he was almost sounding cheerful that the whole story was over and done with. He didn't have to deal with me.
Yeah.
I was gone. Wow. And whatever. She didn't, but then I kept coming back and creating a conflict each time. It's like, theek hai, ab thodi si chance rehne do, because you've done your thing. But then I wanted, for each time my mother and father would have, again, they were in a conflict situation because it's not easy to find a flat each time.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
Right. And here I am saying, find something, because I want you all to also be there.
Yeah.
And I can't just, I'm not here to stay with Richard alone in India.
Yeah.
So until that thing was sorted out 7 years later, it also happened very fortuitously that things got solved. During this time, I was always talking about Richard, and the two children were born already.
Oh, during the 7 years?
Yeah.
Now, oh, wow. And I would have imagined that children shifted everything.
Well, everyone adored the kids. I mean, Kali, first was everyone's completely adored her from top to toe, the oldest to the youngest, and then Manas as well. And I think during this time, there was a grudging admiration that Richard was not making a fuss about my coming. Mm-hmm. And that he was letting me come. Quite unlike a typical Indian husband who would never have allowed the slight to his ego.
Right.
Well, that's interesting.
So I think that the fact that I was going and and talking about Richard and my life and the kids and were there. So when people sort of criticized me so much for not standing by Richard, I personally felt that when things sorted out, it was because I had maintained that relationship with my family. Mm-hmm. And then given them a chance to accept Richard rather than having disappeared for 7 years, 6 years, and not come back home, and had this attitude that I won't come back home unless you accept him, then I don't think he would ever have been accepted. And they could have the joint family would have written me off saying, ki, girls go to America, they don't come back.
Yeah.
And it wouldn't have been that uncommon to not come back for 3, 4, 5 years.
Right.
The husband is not letting... I mean, any story could have been made up. And my parents would have been the ones to suffer because they would have not been seeing me. But I came back every year because I couldn't do anything else. Whether it was right, whether it was wrong, it was an internal compulsion.
Was that just about you? Once the children were born, was that just about you or was it also about them understanding where they came from? How important was that?
Oh, of course, it was totally obsessively important because, as I said, I first told Richard that I'm not coming marrying you until you let me make sure that I go back to India every year and for 3 months.
So that was before you even got married. That was...
Yeah. Because as I said, I really never wanted to leave India. I was one of those snooty, proud... And some matches had come along when I was in New York when Siddharth, my brother, was being treated. One match had come along, a regular sort of corporate type of guy, and nothing wrong with him type of intelligent.
Indian, but he would be in New York?
Yeah, somewhere around, whatever.
Right, somewhere in the States, though, not in India. Right.
You weren't interested.
And I said,
because...
I said no.
Right.
I mean, there was nothing wrong with him. So I said, I don't want to marry any Indian living abroad. I mean, they're creeps. And, so,
she's right. She's not that far from the truth.
You know, so that I and basically, daddy shouldn't come up with Richard, you see, because he stood for other things. He was other things that Indians never are in the States, at least the ones that we knew. They are typical, and they live in these ugly houses with cars in front and snow on top. These were the kind of pictures we would see of people who came back from abroad and lived in suburbia and all of that stuff.
Right.
I want to transition with the time that we have left to having kids that are mixed.
Sorry?
And having kids that are mixed, you know, and we talk about being of feet in both lands because we were raised here and like are ancestrally from there. But your children are even more a foot in both
lands. In a certain sense, ironically, or whatever the word is, yes, because though they don't look Indian, all of them speak and write, read and write Hindi.
Yeah, it was, your daughter's Hindi was great.
It's short of... It's by no means perfect. They still make some grammatical errors and all of that.
Better than
mine. For an American-born, it's very...
Don't like being told that for an American-born. But yeah, they grew up speaking Hindi, basically.
Sometimes you just got to accept facts. You know?
They started speaking Hindi before they started speaking English.
Really?
And they could switch back and forth. And then I was very particular, and my mom also, to teach them every time they were there. They had a tutor, I was spending time reading, making them learn how to read and write, because you can't be illiterate in your own language, and one of them is Hindi. So as a result, they can, of course, as you grow older, it becomes progressively your standard declines, because now you're in school, and even I had to interject English in my speech just to be able to communicate with them.
Right.
So it becomes more of a mishmash. But yeah, but so unlike kids in America, like y'all who have both Indian parents, they had one Indian parent, yet they spoke Hindi, whereas a lot of kids didn't speak Hindi.
Yeah.
And I think that was an unusual situation.
It almost seems like you made even more of an effort because you were the only one. I think my parents, on some level, took for granted that they were Indian, and I was just going to know until they finally, I think my father, when he recognized at some point, he was like, we have to take them back to India for a year, because that was the time when I really got connected to India deeper than just family.
Yeah.
Being there for a year but we didn't learn. I wasn't raised with the language. I wasn't, was Richard always very accepting and cooperative with this idea of sharing identities and
I think
Richard's coming out in this podcast sounding like a G.
An angel.
I mean, just sounding like the best person in the world. He sounds amazing.
That's what everyone says, that they credit Richard with everything. I credit my mother when she
was... I'm going to tell you, we're going to have a little chat about this probably off air, but it sounds you're not giving yourself that much credit.
And I told you, really sure. I give myself credit for falling in love. And
you made choices along the way, though. How can you...
But if I had not... if my mother had not helped me, no matter how much I was in love or whatever, I would never have left. And she knew that. She knew that I wouldn't leave it unless she helped me. All she had to do was not help. And I would never have gone. I wouldn't have known how to leave the house even. I always maintain that my mother deserves the credit for my marriage. And I kept telling her this until the day she died, which was unexpected and totally traumatic. Basically that she gave me this life, and that it was very rich, and that never had I regretted being married to Richard, and
that's an amazing thing.
And she recognized that. She said that we've always felt very intimately about Richard, and she was very intimate with him, and your kids are unique, and I'm really proud of... I said, I have a life in two countries, and it's because of you that I've learned so many things different. My horizons have expanded. Because all of Richard's interests then became my interests, classical music, art, movies, and...
You must have had it. What influence did you have on Richard?
I think that I did bring in family and friends, because as a philosopher and as an only child, he was a bit of a loner. He's an introvert as a personality.
Oh, wow.
And I'm one of a large family. And
you're definitely not an introvert.
Yeah.
Well, I grew up being an introvert. I was an introvert. I had to force myself into talking more than I wanted to talk. I was always aware of what I didn't know, and I felt awkward in certain situations. And there was, you have this idea of what intellectuals are like and how much little less you know than them, which wasn't the feeling I had with Richard, because he was Richard, but then other friends and all of that. Mm-hmm. But it took me a while to find myself, so to say, and feel comfortable with it, and feel that, yes, in a way, whether I had accomplished something in my life or not, in the law, which I wanted to do in a very concrete way, help the disadvantaged, that practice was compromised in a way because I was going to India every summer. And
What I find, you mentioned you brought it back to the service, the work that you do with disadvantage, and I find that to be a very strong thread amongst people that are service oriented. They are very quick to honor those that have helped them, and I think that that's just a really beautiful an understanding of gratitude and showing gratitude to those that help and internalizing that to then give it back. You know, we have models that allow us to teach service that then kind of inspire us to teach more. We are out of time for our episode this time. We're gonna have to bring you back part two. We're gonna have to come back to. We're gonna have to come down to Athens.
We're gonna
have to interview you guys together.
Let me tell you something.
The flip side of this.
Arjun mentions a part two to a lot of guests, and most of the time I'm like, we're probably not gonna bring him back. But this one's happening.
Because I want.
I
mean,
so nice of you. I mean, I must say that it was easy to talk. I kind of got wrapped up in it.
Credit to you guys. I wish that we had more time to... I mean, we both have to run to things. Otherwise, we would just do a two-hour episode because there's so much to unpack in your experience then in Athens and being an Indian mother of children in Athens and that whole experience, which is, definitely something to chat about.
Yeah.
So, guys... We're going to figure out how to make this happen in the coming months, that we're going to come down to Athens and get part two. But, Auntie, thank you so much.
We might even talk to Richard in Athens.
Yeah, absolutely.
That's what I'm saying. We're going to have to get a little dual part, get his side of the story also. Yeah. I mean, that perspective
He likes to be short and succinct, though. Of course, he'll say, get to the point. Well, he tells me when I'm unrolling the story. But, yeah, you'll get a perspective from his side.
He does that because you make him look so incredible. It's like, why would I mess this up?
Auntie, seriously, thank you. I mean,
thank you.
A very
thank you guys.
Thank
well,
you
that's very
generosity.
Nice of you to get
thank
me
you.
To do this. I mean, my children will appreciate it, and so will my husband, because as you heard Kali say, that you never tell the story. As I said, it's always painful to tell it, but it was nice to tell you all.
Well, then we are honored and thank you for feeling safe enough with us and comfortable to share it. And listeners, express your thanks to Sujata Auntie through us, because I'm not going to give out her Twitter. Do you even have Twitter?
I don't know how to use it.
that's the appropriate response. Guys, we're going to do this real quick. Share our stuff on Facebook, please. Rate the podcast. I'm just going to take it away from you, Akash. Rate and review the podcast on iTunes. It really just helps us build this community that we're going to try to build. Reach out to us. Let us know what you're thinking. We still do our community episodes, so we want to hear from you guys. We're really trying to build this community. And we will... we promise you a part to this story, because there's much more to hear. We're coming back next week with another episode, so definitely tune in. I'm Arjun.
I'm Akash.
We'll catch you then.
God bless.